This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
I want to begin this morning with a teaching by Master Hongzhi, who was a very important master in ancient China, about 100 years before the, actually a couple hundred years before the time of Dogen. At the beginning of a practice period, Master Hongzhi taught, ordinary people and sages together share one house. We see our lives as in the Buddha field of tranquil radiance. Then we empty our minds in the hall for creating Buddhas, where some naturally open their flower of awakening in this training garden in the mountains. Committed to never turning away for 90 days, we see the place where we were before we ever took a step. For 3 months of protecting life, enact the body and mind that does not attach to objects. Many bodies peacefully abide within one body, and one body engages the way within many bodies. Therefore, it is said that all Buddha's Dharma bodies enter my nature. My nature joins with and becomes the same as the Tathagata's. So this morning we begin our 90-day training period, which is a continuation of our tradition here since the very beginning, when Dada Roshi first established this mountain training. And every spring and fall, we gather together to begin a period of intensified practice. Traditionally, the Ango, as we call it in our lineage, was done in summer and winter. And so on, going back into the more ancient tradition. For us, spring and fall works very nicely, particularly in accord with the changing of seasons. This tradition itself goes back really to the time of the Buddha, when before there were monasteries or any permanent dwelling places where the monastic community would wander throughout the year, except during the monsoon seasons where they couldn't. In fact, they were not to be wandering during that time. It was too dangerous. And so they would gather together in small groups and practice intensively together, receive teachings, offer teachings during those 3 months, and in that way intensify their practice as a gathered community. And then after the Ango period was over, the rains had ceased, and they would move back out into their wandering lifestyle. And so for all of these hundreds of years, this tradition has continued. In different schools of Buddhism, it's known in different ways. And it's really a wonderful way for the Sangha to gather very consciously during these periods of time and turn our attention more keenly to the Dharma, to our practice. And in doing that, it becomes more present within us, in our consciousness, in our bodies, in what we're doing. And we intensify that through actual practice, through our zazen and our liturgy, our study, both personally, individually, things that we're doing within our own individual practice, in terms of what we're doing together as a sangha. In our affiliate groups, there are things that take place. Our sangha in New Zealand, hello Kiwis, we're live streaming this for them and others. They will be also practicing this in their own way. So they will also have a coming together where they practice together and then do a hike, each in their own places where their different groups are located. We have people in prison who try and engage Ango practice as much as they can from their place. And so in that way, the body of the Sangha becomes very large and Ango becomes very large. Also, before I go any further, I just wanted to acknowledge the installation of our new butsudan. Last May, when I was in Buffalo with our affiliate there, Matod, who is one of our, the husband of one of our students, Karen, who's here today and is part of that sangha, had built one for the Buffalo group. And I was not only admiring it, I was coveting. And, which I was quite honest about. And but I didn't want to add stealing to that. And so... So I left it where it was, and he very, very generously offered to make one for us. And so he's been working on it very diligently and with the express purpose of having it here for us today. So thank you, Matod, for that. It's quite beautiful. So the Sangha is a great ocean gathering as we come together for Ango. And so we join hands and meet together in our dedication, in our aspiration to study and awaken to this Buddha Dharma and to have our lives be ever more one of benefit in this world. And so in this way, we meet our ancestors eyeball to eyeball. We exchange breaths. We hold hands. That's why I felt like it was important that we do a service this morning in the field facing the Buddha, the mountain Buddha, and standing very in direct contact with the many beings, our ancestors, both living here on this mountain, sharing it, providing this mountain for us today, and also all of those ancestors going back, our First Nations ancestors, all those who have been here, who have regarded this area as a place of sacredness, and here now we are. Hongzhi says, ordinary people and sages together share one house. How wonderful. He's speaking the truth, and not just for Buddhists, but for all of us. When we don't know this, then things become very barren and dull. It's that that gives us the mentality and the reasoning, the sort of upside-down reasoning to injure, destroy, turn against that very house that we share together. Because we only have one. It's always been this way. It's one Dharma. It's one Sangha. It's one practice. It's one commitment. It's one earth. It's one autumn. It's one awakening. This home is that large. It is unbounded. It keeps nothing out. It includes everything. And that's where we practice. And we call that a Buddha field. We see our lives, Hongzhi says, as in the Buddha field of tranquil radiance. A Buddha field is a place in which Buddhas practice, Bodhisattvas practice. And we practice to bring forth our own wisdom and compassion. And we practice in that Buddha field to do that for everyone we encounter. And within that field is everything we need. We may see it as a place that's deficit, but that's because we don't see its tranquil radiance. The deficiency, the insufficiency we see is all too often the impoverishment of our mind, believing that we're actually outside of that house. And so with the faith that we share together this one house, we enter into this Buddha field with conviction that it is our place, both within which to practice, to realize, and also to take care of. And it's very simple. It's a place of people, situations, work, things, buildings and bridges. It's a place where we encounter each other. It's a place where we drop away what isn't true, and we bring forth and strengthen what is true, whether they appear true or not. Because things appear to us sometimes as beautiful and sometimes as ugly. And while we can take something sacred and make it appear ugly, in itself it is not. In itself, it doesn't know beauty or ugliness. That's its tranquil radiance. And so then Hongzhi says, within that faith and within that place, we empty our minds in the hall for creating Buddhas. This place, this hall. The hall where you practice at home. The hall where you practice at work. Where would we limit it is really the question, in a sense, the challenge of Ango and all of practice. Where would we not create this, not have this hall be present? We empty our minds in the hall for creating Buddhas, where some naturally open their flower of awakening in this training garden in the mountains. So beautiful. Where some naturally open their flower of awakening in this training garden in the mountains, in which we sow seeds and we bring them to blossom. Committed to never turning away for the whole of the 90 days, we see the place where we were before we ever even took a step. And so we commit to this ancient path here and now. This ancient path which is never past, it's never old, it's never out of date, because it's reality. It's always perfectly in accord with time and place. It knows no other. And we come to study the mind. And he says to empty it of all the obstructions by never turning away, which means we have to become very skillful at recognizing the many ways we turn away. Turn away from ourselves, turn away from the Buddha field, put ourselves out of this one house, put others out of this one house. All of suffering comes down to this. So that we can see that which is before us. So close and so distant, so simple and so challenging. To see that which is before us. And realize that before we ever took a step, here we were. And so Ango entering, offering incense at the threshold, is that, entering this hall of Buddhas. For 3 months of protecting life, for these 3 months we protect life. And of course, Ango is a period of time, a conscious period of time. You know, I've quoted Bodhidharma recently a couple of times, who's quoting the Buddha or referring to how the Buddha took objects, made things tangible to point to that which is inexpressible. How do you turn towards that which can't be seen? How do you study that which you can't touch? How do you realize that which can't be known? And so the Buddha did the only thing that can be done, which is to take that which is tangible, a training hall, a practice schedule, a period of time, various forms of practice, vows, commitments, so that we can turn our attention to those tangible things, enter into that one house, meet that tranquil radiance within ourselves, and realize that which can't be known. And so we make our whole body and mind, our thoughts, words, and actions, our walking and sitting, our living, our suffering, a mantra. A moment-to-moment mantra. Mantra means to protect your mind. Hongzhi speaks of it as emptying the mind of all obstructions. So you think of every moment making your body, your mind, your practice, your intention, your awareness a mantra. And this is not a protection that builds a wall around you or that denies all that is difficult. It's a gateless gate. It's protection by realizing we are vast and boundless. by not attaching to objects, by mindfulness and samadhi concentration. And here he says, enact your body and mind that doesn't attach to objects, so that you can see that many bodies peacefully abide within this one body. The many bodies in your mind, the many bodies of your feelings and emotions, the many streams of your karma. Enact that body and mind, all those bodies and minds within the one body, and bring them into a state of peacefulness. And that must be done authentically, which means we can't do it by idea. We have to do it by practice. Therefore, it is said that all Buddhas, Dharma bodies, enter my nature, your nature. They already reside here. And your nature joins with and becomes the same as all the Buddhas. Meeting eyes, exchanging breaths, holding hands, sitting on the same seat. And so in this way, we're not just continuing a tradition, doing something that has been done before. But we do that so that we can encounter our ancestors today, here. Not as abstractions, not as distant, myth-like, or mythical-like beings, but as our own body and mind. A great ocean gathering. And so Ango is a place and a time when we do that. And is true for, you know, in every form of practice that we do, we're essentially doing what we always do. You know? But we're doing it with a more heightened awareness, with a direct focus, with more an increased commitment. And throughout the year, Anga also serves the function of pulsing. It's like the seasons, right? They wax and wane like the seasons of the moon, right? Nothing is static. Everything is moving. Every stream is flowing towards the great ocean. And so how do we, with all of our movements, with our energies, with our life, and our karmic patterns, how do we move within that stream in a way that is skillful? And so part of the skillfulness of Ango is that we step forward for 3 months and deliberately intensify, which means we stretch ourselves. We do more. And so we might get up earlier to sit zazen. We might sit longer. We might sit at different times during the day. We might do more liturgy. Engage in the different areas of training, our practice and study practice and body practice. We might be engaging the precepts in a different way or in a more intensified, more conscious way. We may be engaging in other actions that we're involved in, the Beyond Fear of Differences and the Earth Initiative, in more heightened, more intensified ways. And all of that is both expressing, bringing us forward, moving us along the path, and it's also filling our consciousness. You know, mindfulness in its base means to remember. And so when you are remembering the Dharma, when you're thinking of the Dharma, when you are conscious of the Dharma, it's in you in a way that you recognize and it affects you. And it comes out in what you do. When we forget, that's not happening. And so in all of these ways in which we're intensive, it's not just intensity. For intensity's sake, it's so that it is more and more present within us. It's more integrated, it's more consistent, there's more constancy. The theme for our Ango is the Eightfold Path. And as I say, probably every Ango, that everything we have is always present within everything we're doing. It's not like we seize on something that is completely outside. There's nothing outside. And how could that be more true than with the Eightfold Path? But by turning towards it and really concentrating our study of it and our practice of it, it becomes more, we become more aware of it. We guide ourselves, we learn more deeply about this incredibly profound teaching, which means we're able to practice it more, better, and it becomes more embodied. And so during the Ango, we'll be here at the monastery, at the temple, we'll be intensifying practice in various ways, we'll be doing mandos, so there'll be sessions throughout the fall on the different of the Eightfold Path. So next Thursday we'll be starting at 7:30, we'll be starting the first of these, and we'll be starting where we need to, which is with the Four Noble Truths, the first teaching of the Buddha, which was the first time in which he presented the Eightfold Path. So just think of that as a moment in time. Right? And a few of us were fortunate enough to be in India a couple of years ago, where we went to Deer Park, and we're standing in that very place where the Buddha first came and met with his first students and began teaching this teaching, which is still echoing down to today. Hogan Sensei will also be offering a workshop in the city in September on the Eightfold Path. And this series that I'll be doing will go on into the winter. We're not going to be able to do them all this Ango, so we'll just carry it on into the winter. Also, Rebecca Lee, who's a teacher, a disciple of Master Sheng Yen, the late Master Sheng Yen, will be offering a retreat here in November on the Four Noble Truths, which is really nice. How that all works is going to work together. The study sessions, we're going to be, Hoki, we're going to be recording those. Yes. So those will be available online. there are readings that are in the Ango information that's on the website. So, as soon as the Ango ends, I sort of start the next one. And so I begin thinking about and preparing for the next Ango. And so during the summer, I've been looking at different texts by different teachers on the Eightfold Path, and those are listed on the website. And so I'll be working with the one by Piyadasi Thera, but the others are also fine. And I won't be working with it page by page, so whatever text you read will be fine. But it would be good to be using this period as a time to actually do study, so that you're examining these teachings from these various teachers, and then I'll be picking up on that and expanding on that. During October, we'll do our Ango Intensive, which we do every Ango, which will be from a Thursday to Sunday in October. And I'm going to focus on the seven factors of enlightenment, which was an original teaching of the Buddha as well, in which both mindfulness and concentration play a very important role, as well as other factors that the Buddha spoke of, which are all really important for this path. And so in that way, we'll sort of bring together the Eightfold Path with these seven factors of enlightenment in a way that I think will be quite nice. Maybe would you like to say a few words about the art practice? Hojin Sensei is going to say a little bit about the art practice.
I'll try to say just a little bit about the art practice. And it's great just how this garden that was spoken of. We'll be working with illuminated journals. So illuminate, light up, shine on. So it's the art of noticing and live recordings. It's a three treasure hunt of everything that is right in front of us. And because it's impermanent, we'll be able to see the changes and record our life day by day. It should be a journal with at least 90 pages. So you get to work every day. Alan Watts used to speak of the Zen arts as effing the ineffable. So it's kind of like that. We're going to F page by page with images, words, cutouts, paste-ins. It's a journal that can hold anything and everything. Yesterday we made a live recording of a session I did on it, so that'll be posted to help you enter. We're mark-making, exploring colors, materials. So all you need is a journal, one that you would love to carry and work in. Check your drawers for all those odds and ends, pencils, crowns, markers that are floating, and gather them up in a bag, and everything else you have. And we'll be informed by this on the bon voyage on that. And then we can share at the end. It's not a personal journal, so actually anyone and everything can enter in, so people can add to your journal. You can look closely at your children, the mountain, far away, near, up, down, in all directions. And what do you notice? It's getting closer, getting quieter, so we can really study. And when we do that intimacy with something, of course it happens the other way as well. So it's going to keep informing everything we do and bring us closer to home and our peaceful dwelling.
Thank you. You know, when we do spring ongo, it's it's cold when we start. Usually the mountain's covered in snow and ice, and it's hard to get out for a while until towards the latter part of the ongo. And so it's nice to take advantage of the fall season, because it's still nice out and will be probably throughout. And so I really want to encourage all of us to use our earth, to use, you know, we are physical beings. And for all of the time, you know, that this tradition, this awakening path began underneath a tree, at the foot of a tree, on bare ground, with the sky overhead, and the sun and the moon, and the insects and the heat and the cold. All of it was there. It wasn't always, right, easy. But the Buddha was always in direct contact with his elements, inside and outside. And as I think, I hope, I certainly experienced it this morning, you know, to stand outside, to stand on the grass, to be surrounded, right, by this mountain and this earth, and come into direct contact through our senses, right, it comes closer. And that is very, very deep within us. You know, we've only been living like this for not that long. And as we have moved further and further away, further and further away, we do that at our not only our detriment, but at our great peril. And so I want to encourage us to use this ongo to, with art practice, if you can do your meditation outside. Do your meditation outside. In other words, to use the season and wherever you are. When I was living in the city for 10 years at the temple, during those first few years, I spent a lot of time looking for the places where I could go, which were actually and literally right outside. Right? New York City is, in many parts, a city of trees and parks, but I also looked for other places. And I look for the places that I was drawn to, that drew me to them. Having found those places up here, I looked for those places in the city, and because I knew those were the places that I would go to again and again, and find nourishment and companionship and teachings and contact. And so I really encourage us to do that and to see that as integrated with our practice. During the ongo, this month, in fact, as many of you know, there's a climate summit at the UN later in September. And on September 20th, on Friday, there's a climate strike, which was begun by Greta Thunberg, a young woman from Sweden who, just on her own, without any big plan, just started doing what needed to be done, and is changing the world. And so she has taken a slow boat to the U.S. And will be at that, will be speaking to the UN, the assembly, but will also be part of a general strike, which is being called on September 20th, which is a Friday, downtown in Manhattan. And so we're all going to be trying to gather, encourage the Sangha from upstate, from the city, from wherever. And there are also lots of these happening all around the world and country. And so if New York is too far to travel, look for a place in your own area. And so that we can all show up together and show and enact our body and mind on behalf of the earth, which means everything and everyone. And so I want to really put a underline on that. Also, David Loy, who's a Buddhist practitioner and teacher, he studied within the Yamada and Aiken Roshi lineage, and has recently published a book called Echo Dharma, which is quite good, and encourage you to read it, where he's really looking at the relationship between the Dharma and the climate emergency. He's going to be giving a talk as part of a series at Union Theological Seminary, and is going to do a special sort of smaller session at the temple. And so that's already online if you're interested. It's going to be limited to a certain number of people to try and keep it contained so that it's a good, juicy meeting. And so that's also going to be happening. He's also coming, but I think not until next year. Is that right, Sarah? I believe, yeah. So, but he'll be at the temple during the Ango. So that's really nice. And in that way, the Illuminated Journal, the climate strike, what I'm speaking about in terms of just trying to really bring the earth into more direct contact, all of these working together. Something that Hojin Sensei and I have been talking about a lot, we really want to work at how to do this, enact this more and more within our Sangha, and also, and very importantly, in terms of actual practice. Haven't quite figured out the logistics of how to do a session with 90 people outside. just imagine Orioki. we'll work on that. Also, in terms of the beyond fear of differences, which these are the different things that are, you know, not sort of, sidecars to our training, but are really, you know, integrated more and more with our training, that they're not just things that are sort of hanging on like a separate room, but they're really in this one house. And they're things that I and we feel like are really important for us to be attending to, because they're both places of great, great suffering, and our vow is to alleviate suffering, and also places of tremendously important and powerful practice. And so the Beyond Fear of Differences is our anti-racist, anti-gender oppression, anti-oppression in all ways work. And one of the things that I would like to encourage everybody to do is this rather extraordinary series in the Times and the Washington Post on slavery and the legacy of slavery, which is still so much with us today. And these different series of articles, which have been so powerful and smart and incisive and revelatory, I think, for many, particularly if we haven't been studying this, and we need to be. And so we're going to be printing all of these out and putting them in the common rooms, but I just really encourage you to go to those sites and avail yourself of this incredible offering that these various scholars and journalists and various people have been creating in all different aspects. It's just been really amazing. And I think it's very much, I see it, I interpret it as a part of a revolution which we're in the midst of. conversations that have been had for many, many hundreds of years, but not within the larger public. Certainly not largely within the white community. And these are incredibly astute and intelligent and deep thinking and connection-making articles that people are writing about and bringing in all of the ways in which really connecting in powerful ways the very origins and the early hundreds of years of the history of slavery and oppression, but also how those are manifest now. In other words, what is the karmic legacy of these that are very much present? And that's just teaching us about karma itself. That karma does not go away. When we don't attend to it, it continues on and on and on. It just changes forms. It keeps changing form. Which makes it easy for some to not see it. And those some are usually people who are not being directly affected or don't know that they're being directly affected. And so those will also be aspects of the Ango. Another aspect is sitting next to me. Sorry to speak of you as an aspect. So Yosha has been training here for many years. She became a student in 2008 and did Jikai, took the Bodhisattva precepts in 2014. And she lives nearby, and so she's been able to be very active over those many years. She's a professional librarian. She's a parent. She's a person. She's a Buddha. And she's also a parent of a child, one in particular, Lillian, who's been very active here and grew up with the Zen kids and Zen teens and has done periods of residency here. I was hoping she would be here today, but not possible. So it's a family affair. It is one house. And so Yosha's offering and challenge, which she has eagerly stepped into, is the role of chief disciple, which is to step into a role of providing example by her own practice. And it's really important to appreciate that that's how we train, you know, so that when we step into a role, we are ready to step in that role, and at the same time, we're not ready because we haven't done it yet. And so the whole thing is you're learning on the spot. And because we train together, it means you're also learning and training publicly. And that's part of it, is that we do that together, that these many Dharma bodies joined together in one body, the person who's training. And that one body also extends into the many bodies. And in that way, we are interfused. And we also provide examples to each other of how to learn, which means we see examples of how people step in, even when they're anxious, how they step in with confidence, even when they feel like they might not yet be fully ready. How they step in with the aspiration to do their best and at various points will stumble or falter, right? And then step again. And being able to see that, and we don't witness all of it, right? Because we're not there in every moment. And we don't even recognize sometimes where the faltering is taking place. But the person who's faltering sure as hell knows, right? And the fact that it is happening publicly, they think everybody knows, right? And so it's very much live. And the point of that is to, in a sense, show that that's always happening. It's always live. It's always live. And in a sense, we are always showing ourselves. We're always revealing ourselves. And that's not a bad thing unless we're invested in concealment, right? Then that's not such a good thing. But here we are not. We are invested in vast and boundless. And so it's just a really important thing to appreciate because we might sort of be dimly aware of it but not really understand how important that is, that we train together, live, on the spot. And so everything that Yosha will be doing in the beginning will be for the first time, right? And then over the 3 months, it will become a little bit more confident. But 3 months isn't even that long a period of time. And so it continues. And that happens with every training position. And this is a training position. And the more responsibility we have, in a sense, the more obligation we hold to the Sangha, not to perform, not to be perfect, because that's a dangerous illusion. And I really mean that. It's a dangerous illusion. But to do something that we all can do and seems so simple, which is to do your best. That's it. We are asked to do our best and to never fix what that is. Just don't fix it. Don't know. And just aspire to, in every moment, do your best. It's what I do. And at every moment, I strive to do my best. Do I always do that? No. And that is part of the path, right? Because it's real. It's live. And that not doing your best becomes, when you're awake and when you want to do your best, part of our development. What would we leave out of this house? What would we not include? What would we waste as having no possibility of teaching you something? To me, that is the splendor, the bounty of the Dharma. Is it's not just a comforting notion that everything, right, is the path, or everything is there to teach you something, because that sentiment exists. You can read it on a fortune cookie. But what the hell does it mean? How do you do that? How do you make that real? And what the Buddha has given us is the most powerful thing, which in a sense is not his enlightenment, although everything arose out of his enlightenment, but it was this teaching, the Eightfold Path. Because if he had just had his enlightenment and come out to the world and said, "I am the world honored one. See you later." We wouldn't be sitting here. We wouldn't even know about it. He didn't do that. He spent the rest of all, the whole of his life, and the better part of his life, all the way into his last breath, and then beyond, giving us all that he had. And he said that over and over. He said, I do not teach with a concealed or closed fist. He said, everything that I have to offer, I'm offering. Nothing is held back. He held nothing back. That's what we've received. And so in this Sangha, we come together to turn our attention and receive that. So I want to conclude with... I think I said everything I wanted to say, with a teaching of the Buddha. And before I do that, just that we're ending a little bit early, and we'll go down and have lunch. And the store will be open. If you'd like to enjoy the store, please do. And we're going to try and finish things up a little sooner than later, than so in the kitchen and in the store, so that we can head off up the mountain. And this is a tradition that we started many years ago. In fact, the first time we did it, we didn't really know what we were doing. It was spring, and it was cold. And it was really, the winter was not over by a long shot. And we didn't really know what we were doing, because we'd never done it before. So we had a very casual lunch and took our time. By the time we got out, there wasn't a whole lot of daylight left. So by the time we got up, it was so cold that Kyoto's camera froze. We couldn't take a photo of us on the top. And by the time we were coming down, it was dark. So when we got to the road, Dadaroshi was out in the car thinking he just lost the Sangha. But we made it. And so for many, many years, we went up the main trail to Mount Tremper. In the last few years, I've wanted to switch that because that trail is so, you know, it's like how we love things to death. It's so used, and unfortunately, it's not maintained because we don't value such things and give money for it. So the trail is really eroded. So I always feel bad when we take a big group of people up that trail. So we have found another trail, which is much, much less used and is in really good shape and is quite beautiful and is also a little bit more accessible, although there is a little bit of climbing, so you need to be able to climb over some rocks and just carry yourself up. And it has some gorgeous outlooks over the mountains. And so we will take our hike up there. And this tradition, it said, goes back to Dogen, who loved the mountain and would climb to the top of Ehe Mountain at the beginning of each Ango. So we'll go up there together, those of you who would like to go with us, and we'll do a service, and then we'll finish our day there. And so the Buddha taught this in the Dhammapada. This is the path itself, for none other leads to the purity, clear vision. If you follow it, and so confuse Mara, all of your obstructions and inner entanglements, all suffering will end. Since I have learned how to remove the arrows that inflict all the pain and suffering that we inflict within ourselves, since I have learned how to remove the arrows, I have revealed the path, the Noble Eightfold Path, in which you should always strive. The Buddhas only teach, that's what they do, they only teach those who walk in meditation and the time-honored practices will free themselves from Mara's grasp. The Buddhas can only teach. Each of us then must walk in meditation, walk in this Eightfold Path to free ourselves of all of our sorrow. So, we begin. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma Talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JIZOPROJECT.